It's primary election day in Illinois. We'll hear how polling places around the state are addressing coronavirus concerns. Plus, some Illinois libraries are changing their late fee policies in an effort to help the patrons who rely on their services the most. And we'll listen back to our conversation about a dance class that is helping people living with Parkinson's disease.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up on the 21st. Please stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Coming up later this hour, we will check in with libraries across Illinois that are working on alternatives to charging late fees for overdue books. And research shows dance and the arts can be beneficial for people living with Parkinson's. We'll hear about one of those classes that happens in Champaign, Urbana. But first, as of this morning, there are 105 COVID-19 cases spread across 15 counties in Illinois. Until March 30th, schools have been ordered closed, as well as restaurants for in-person dining. It's an effort to add physical distancing and stop the spread of the lethal disease. Today is also primary day in Illinois. Democratic voters are heading to the polls to decide whether they think Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders should challenge Donald Trump for the presidency in November. Five Republicans are vying to unseat U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. The impending retirement of Congressman John Shimkus in the 15th Congressional District has triggered a spirited primary. There are four Democrats and four Republicans in that race. Voters will also choose Republicans to face U.S. Representatives Sean Casten and Lauren Underwood in November. We wanted to know how county clerks around the 21st state are handling primary day. Joining us on the line right now, Thomas Ride, who is the executive director of the Peoria County Election Commission. Hello, Thomas.
Hello.
Also, Doug Johnson, he is the DeKalb County Clerk Recorder and the Chief Election Official for DeKalb County. Welcome, Doug.
Good morning.
And we're also joined by Kevin Haas, Metro Editor at the Rockford Register Star newspaper. Hello, Kevin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tom, let's start with you. How has turnout so far been today in the Peoria area?
It's been pretty slow. We're actually very slow for this type of election.
Let's head north now. Doug, what are you seeing as far as turnout in the DeKalb County area?
I would say DeKalb County is running about normal for a primary election today. We've had our morning rush of people that usually show up in the morning, and then, of course, we're getting close to lunchtime, which is another time when it comes in. But our early voting had a little pickup in the last 2 days. Prior to the election, and we're up a little bit on early voting. But as far as today, it's about normal.
And Kevin, your newspaper journalists have been out and about already today. What are they seeing in Rockford?
Well, definitely we're seeing election judges taking on some new duties at the polls today. At the polling place that I went out to this morning, they hand you a pen at your first check-in, and you take that pen with you all the way through the process, hand it to someone at the end who then disinfects it, and they're encouraging everyone at each stop to stand 6 feet apart. So limiting the spread of the virus is definitely top of mind at all the polling places we're seeing here in Rockford.
Let's talk about election judges. We know that there's been a lot of concern about the cancellation of judges. Many happen to be older, the population that is most at risk of possibly getting COVID-19 and having a serious illness. Champaign County here in central Illinois says 100 election judges dropped out of today's primary due to the fears of the coronavirus. Macon County, where Decatur is, lost 70 judges. Tom, I know you're there in Peoria County. What percentage of judges canceled within the past week?
We lost about 40% of our judges in the last week. We had about 160 judges cancel on us.
And was it all due to fears over the virus?
That was the predominant. We always have a handful of you know, people that drop out for other reasons. They don't feel well or an issue with the family. But the vast majority, yes, was directly related to the coronavirus.
How have the cancellations affected your precincts today?
We have a lot of new young judges in our polling places. We put out a call starting last Friday and got a really good response. We have a lot of student judges working. We have some a lot of just new judges that are working, and we trained at the last minute. We placed 69 judges just yesterday out of 350.
Doug, I understand you also had some cancellations in DeKalb County, but other folks jumped in to help.
Yeah, we had about 6 to 8 judges that either didn't feel well. There's another flu bug going around up here right now, not the coronavirus. There's just the standard flu going around, so we're having some issues with that. 6 to 8 judges canceled on us, but we're a university county, Northern Illinois University, and we have some people from college that are on spring break and have come home, and they were election judges when they were in high school, so they've called us up, stepped up, and said, what can we do to help? Really great response across DeKalb County of people kicking in, wondering what they can do to help and make this a better situation.
And Kevin, let's talk a little bit about yesterday, you know, the last day of early voting. You certainly, and you kind of alluded to it today, some of the space distancing they're giving voters. What was the scene yesterday as you went around to precincts on the last day of early voting?
Well, city officials here have really put a big push for early voting before today's election as they try to encourage social distancing. And yesterday, if you went by the Rockford Board of Elections early voting site, you'd see a line, you know, wrapping, you know, maybe 20, 30 yards outside the building. Not all of that was because it was a huge early voting rush. In fact, most of it was just because they were enforcing that 6-foot social distancing rule. So you had, just 20 or 30 people in line could really stretch that thing around the block. And it doesn't look like we have a high uptick in early voting. In fact, it's pretty much on pace as of what we learned yesterday from past presidential primaries.
Doug, when it comes to the facilities, the voting booths, what have you done to ensure the safety of election judges and voters there in DeKalb County?
We have provided hand sanitizer for every precinct. We also have provided sanitation wipes. The wipes, the election judges have been given informational material from the DeKalb County Health Department on how to stay safe, healthy hygiene habits, and what to do with the equipment. Some of the equipment is sensitive to how it's cleaned, so we need to be careful with that. But I think all our judges have been informed. They have we provided them with that information at all the polling places. As I'm going around today to the polling places, I'm seeing that they've posted that for the voters to read. I'm seeing judges cleaning pens and equipment and booths at our senior centers. The senior center people have their cleaning people there that are sanitizing. It almost looks like every hour they're going through and wiping things down. So I am feeling very confident that everybody has stepped up and is following the information given out by the health departments and working to make this a safe environment.
We're speaking with DeKalb County Clerk Recorder Doug Johnson, Thomas Bride, the Executive Director of the Peoria County Election Commission, and Kevin Haas, Metro Editor with Rockford Register-Star newspaper. We know it's convenient for older voters to have a polling place in their senior care facilities, but with COVID-19 being such a threat to seniors in particular, many places had to move polling places. Tom, I understand that's the situation where you are in Peoria County.
Yeah, we were contacted by one of the three that we used last Tuesday, and at that point we reached out to the other two locations, and we ended up moving three polling places and the voters associated with that to other polling places last Tuesday. The nice thing is being a little proactive, we were able to notify all the affected voters by mail.
Doug, you spoke with directors of senior centers in your area. What did you say to them to reassure them that today's vote will be safe?
Well, one of the issues I had with moving polling places out of senior centers would be that I would have had to have moved them to another polling place, which in effect would have just compounded the issue of more voters in a small area. And so we made the determination when talking with the senior centers that it was better to keep their residents in that polling place along with the residents that live around that polling place and just do an added extra effort of sanitizing. The other thing we did is in the senior centers where the polling places are located is segregated away from the rest of the general population. There's barriers that have been set up to keep the general public from wandering off into the facility or any of the residents of the facility to be out wandering around with the people that are coming in. So, you know, with those segregation and those sanitation issues put in place, the senior center directors and myself, the city of DeKalb, and other health officials believed that we were covering all bases.
Now, yesterday, Governor J.B. Pritzker defended the decision to hold the Illinois primary today, despite the school, bar, and restaurant closures he's mandated to slow the spread of the coronavirus. Here's what he had to say.
At those polling places, there really won't be too many people at any given time, so people can really feel safe, just like when they go to the store, to the grocery store to buy something, or they, you know, go to a local store at any given time. You know, it's not jam-packed with people.
We should mention Arizona and Florida are also holding primaries today. Ohio's public health director ordered the polls closed as a public health emergency. Tom, you're the leader of the Peoria County Election Commission. Do you think the governor made the right call to keep the primary going today?
I agree that it's a really difficult call to make. I think it probably was the right decision just because of the chaos it could have caused if you were to cancel it. I mean, as of right now, we had more people vote early than we've had vote on election day. And I think Illinois has a very strong vote by mail and early voting process. And if you cancel that, I don't know. I mean, or you postpone it, that drags it out longer. And I think you really get into pretty confusing territory. And also understanding that, we deliver everything the day before. Most jurisdictions do too. We, you know, if you call it the night before, everything's already sitting out there. And then you start to have some concerns about having the equipment delivered and try how to communicate to people in the confusion. I think it got down to the point where it was just too late to change it.
Doug, what precautions are you taking when it comes to counting ballots tonight in DeKalb County?
Well, we don't count the physical ballots. The machines that we have set up are the ones that do that, and it's a scanner, and then there's a USB drive in there that we use to upload the results. The only time we will use the paper ballots that we have to make an actual count is if there was a protest or problems with the equipment. So uploading the USB drive, of course, you can use sanitation facilities, but you know the technicians that put those in and I'll be taking them out are the same people that are taking them out. So there hasn't been a lot of touching by other people or contact by other people with that information.
And do you think the governor made the right choice by going forward with the primary today?
Yes, I do. The cost to the taxpayers for us to try and redo this, or not redo, but to pull all the equipment back in, redo it and everything and get it sent back out would have been horrendous. The confusion to the voters, plus the voter apathy that might have been put in place by people getting upset with that. So I believe it was the right call on the governor. I'm hoping that this will be over soon and we can go back on to regular life.
Kevin, I know many of us journalists expect to go to election night watch parties for different candidates tonight as they wait for results and reaction. How has the need for social distancing changed for that tonight?
Yeah, the local GOP and the Democratic Central Committee in Winnebago County both called off their watch parties as per the recommendations. In fact, it's just a different animal than we're used to from the news side. You know, we're all essentially working from the field or from home tonight rather than in a central newsroom setting. So it's a little bit different for us as journalists as we track down information online and in other ways than we may have normally in past elections.
And Doug, I understand you've seen you saw an uptick in early voting this year. Do you attribute that to coronavirus concerns or other factors?
Well, I think it's both. I think the coronavirus and the media coverage of it and the fact that the media was saying to get out, I think there was more coverage pushing early voting by the media because of the virus. So I don't know if you call that the virus or just the media input, but it seems we had a lot more free advertising to get the word out to come in and early vote. And I think I would put it to that more so than the virus.
Tom, what about you? Have you seen an increase in voting by mail or absentee ballots?
We did. We saw an increase. The voting by mail has been increasing pretty much every election, at least as a percentage. But we saw a spike of about 40% of early voting from the primary in 2016, and we saw a significant increase in the vote by mail and a spike right at the end. I think directly related, and the spike in early voting directly related to the concerns that were out there. And I also agree that the media was talking a lot about early.
Well, we've been talking with DeKalb County Clerk Recorder Doug Johnson, Thomas Bride, the Executive Director of the Peoria County Election Commission, and Kevin Haas, Metro Editor with the Rockford Register-Star newspaper, about the effect of coronavirus concerns on today's primary. I know it's a very busy day. Thank all three of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, the past fall, the Chicago Public Library System eliminated late fees and removed outstanding debt for library patrons. They're just one of several library systems here in Illinois that are moving away from charging late fees. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. For 150 years, Busey has helped business owners and entrepreneurs navigate financial decisions, achieve long-term goals, and realize dreams of success. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Public libraries have long relied on late fees as a way of encouraging patrons to return books before they're due. But a growing number of libraries across the country are changing that, saying the policy disproportionately affects people from disadvantaged communities. At the beginning of last year, the American Library Association passed a resolution recognizing fines as a, quote, form of social inequity. The organization has called on libraries nationwide to find a way to eliminate the practice. Since then, libraries from San Diego to Boston, and even here in Illinois, have made changes to their policies. Many libraries, the center of the public in a lot of communities, are closed now to promote social distancing to slow the spread of the coronavirus. But back in October, the Chicago Public Library System, one of the largest in the country, announced that it would be eliminating late fees and removing outstanding debt for library patrons. Around that time, Christine Herman spoke with Chicago's Library Commissioner Andrea Telly, along with Jeannie Hamilton. She's the library director for the Bloomington Public Library.
Andrea, Jeannie, both of you, welcome to the 21st, and thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Andrea, let's start with you. Chicago is one of the largest library systems in the country. What happened in the weeks after this policy change? I understand there was something kind of dramatic and unexpected.
There absolutely was. So we went fine free in Chicago, or we eliminated overdue fines. I don't want to say that we went completely fine free, but we eliminated overdue fines on October 1st. And our circulation numbers for the ensuing 2 months afterwards, for October and November, went up relatively dramatically. So we've seen an increase in people checking books in and out. Our circulation numbers are up by about 20% over last year. Usually those numbers go up and down by about 4 or 5%, so the 22% increase has really been dramatic.
And there was even an increase in the amount of books you were seeing come back, is that right?
Sure, and that was is the other amazing thing. So just during the first couple weeks of us going fine free, numbers were up really, really dramatically, 150-200%. And we knew that would be right, that would regulate, after several weeks. So now, actually, that we're about 2 months into eliminating overdue fines, we're still seeing an unprecedented number of overdue items come back, basically just doubling kind of the normal number of items that we see coming back.
And do you think it's because people are like, oh, I'm not going to be punished for this being late, I'll go ahead and bring it back now? Do you think that's what's behind that?
I think that absolutely that's behind that. I mean, when we were doing research about going fine free, I mean, we were really studying this problem. We were seeing a lot of other library systems going fine free, so we took a look at our own statistics, and we found that we were not only not receiving the revenue that we thought we would be receiving by overdue fines, but we were not receiving the items themselves, the books, which is the asset, the main asset of a library system. And then we were losing patrons as well. So to see not only the items coming back, but also our patrons coming back is really heartening.
Hmm. Andrea, I want to get more into some of the specifics of the new policy. But first, I actually went outside to the Urbana Free Library recently to ask people about their experiences with late fees at libraries. Here's what Urbana resident Emma Fleming had to say.
If libraries were to get rid of late fees, it would actually benefit book return. Because I think it's almost intimidating to come back when I have the late fee and I, am returning the book and I feel like people are judging me.
And here's Lydia Gallagher sharing her experience as well.
I do have late fees and I'm kind of nervous to go inside because I hope I can get my stuff today. But I've definitely gotten rid of a whole new address and gotten a new card to avoid my late fees. Sorry if there's $45 worth of late fees on a separate card. But I'd love to get them gone.
Those were Lydia Gallagher and Emma Fleming speaking with me outside the Urbana Free Library recently. They're talking about late fees and how it can be really intimidating to come back to the library. And that's really interesting, Andrea, because you're saying that's what you saw after the Chicago Public Library system changed. And how much of that was part of your consideration? And what were some of the other factors as well?
Sure. Well, that was a huge part of certainly our consideration because, I think that when, you don't want to feel, you are embarrassed when you sort of rack up, overdue fines, and particularly if you're checking out more than, 5 or 10 books at a time. So we wanted to make sure that people were feeling good about coming back to the library. The other thing that we did, and again, I know that this is, because of the size of Chicago, but we took a look at Chicago demographically. So our system is divided into 3 districts, and we found that patrons that lived in our South District, which has more socioeconomic struggles than other areas of the city, patrons' cards were blocked about 30% of the time. So 1 in 3 patrons' cards were blocked because of overdue fines. As you moved north in the city, where things are not so challenging in terms of jobs and finances and that sort of thing, patrons in our Central District, about 1 in 4 cards were blocked, and then when you get to the North District, 1 in 6 cards were blocked. So we wanted to make sure that people weren't being penalized because they weren't able to pay their fines. We weren't penalized because they were maybe struggling with looking for a job or struggling in other ways. So we wanted to make sure that we were providing access and equity on a very consistent basis across the city of Chicago.
Yeah, and that really gets at the heart of what the American Library Association has said about fines being considered like a form of social inequity. Andrea, I wonder just briefly if you could explain how the model works exactly. So it's not exactly that there are no fines, but there have been some significant changes.
We have had significant changes. So we did eliminate all existing fines from patron records, but we didn't eliminate the cost of books for books that were overdue. So we really wanted the materials back. So if a patron is checking out books and they can't get them back to the library on time, they can return them overdue. And all will be forgiven. But if someone loses a book or, if another patron is waiting for a book that someone has, they have 7 days in which to return the book. If that item isn't returned within the 7 days of its ultimate due date, then the book does what we call go lost. The patron isn't able to use the library until they return that item. Okay. If they're unable to return the item, you're still responsible for the cost of the book.
Got it. That's Andrea Telly, Commissioner of Chicago Public Libraries. We're also joined by Jeannie Hamilton, who's based in Bloomington at the Bloomington Public Library. She's the director there. Jeannie, you and your team have also been working with different libraries across the state on different solutions for dealing with late fees. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you ended up doing with the Fresh Start program in Bloomington?
Sure. Last March, we switched to a new online catalog and library management system, and we felt like it was a great opportunity to dip our toe into the waters, remove some of those barriers that we've talked about. So what we did is leading up to our migration date, and then on the migration date and a little bit after, we waived all existing fines on patrons' accounts. And then we also worked even more with them than we had in the past on really old lost items, so things that have been lost for a really long time. And so on that migration date, we just didn't migrate any of the fines. But before that, we did have really a lot of personal interactions where we were able to say, all of your fines are cleared now. So it was a really neat experience.
Yeah, and Jeannie, I wonder how have people responded to that program? What have you heard from patrons or seen yourself?
We've had a great response. One really touching story is that a parent who didn't have custody of their children came in during that period leading up to the migration and asked us if we could take care of the fines on their children's account. And then they were so happy to be able to provide in that way for their kids, and that they were going to then go back and share with the guardians of the kids that what they had done.
Wow. So, Jeannie, I mean, following this WIPE and Fresh Start program earlier this year, the library has continued to collect late fees, but you also work with patrons who might need additional support or a payment plan, for example, right? How does that work?
So we do have our frontline staff are very empowered to work with the patrons, and we've seen a shift, too, since they had that experience in March where they we saw it was very freeing for them. So they saw the joy that they were able to impact in patrons' lives, and so now we see that a shift in attitude that before maybe there was a little bit of fear that, oh, if I waive these fines, then maybe they'll take advantage of the system, and we're seeing that that fear drop away, and so they're very willing to work with patrons. And then if they feel like it's, you know, a little bit too large of an amount on account, then that can be referred to a manager, and our circulation and outreach managers just really works with the people and sees what they can do. You know, if they ask if can you pay a certain amount today, then we'll waive the rest of it, or can we set up a payment plan for you? So really working to find out how we can best help that person in their individual situation.
That's Jeannie Hamilton. She's the library director at Bloomington Public Library. I'm also speaking with Andrea Telly, who's commissioner at the Chicago Public Libraries. I mean, Andrea, I wanted to step back a bit and just talk a little bit about libraries being a place. It's more than just a place where people go to check out books. I mean, patrons use computers to look for jobs, to pay bills. It's also a safe place for kids to come after school. There's all sorts of classes you can take at the library. I think for that reason, oftentimes libraries have been seen as innovators in terms of social equity and education. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how some of these changes to how libraries deal with late fees is sort of like another step in that direction.
Sure. I think that, I mean, I think you've said it really perfectly in a lot of ways. Libraries are really kind of the last, or not the last, but certainly a truly democratic institution in a community. You don't have to belong to a certain socioeconomic group. You don't have to have attained a certain educational level. You don't really even have to know how to read to use the library. And so I think that libraries have done a really wonderful job in re-envisioning themselves as technology has changed. I mean, we've been doing it for the last, 200 years, really. And you're absolutely right. Libraries have become community centers, certainly in this last generation. So there are classes that you can take when you come to the library. In Chicago, we're the largest provider of free internet service across the city. So we have people coming into the libraries to look for jobs, to hone their own skills using our databases. I mean, certainly still to look for books and materials. And so there are infinite possibilities in a library today, I think.
And Jeannie, I wonder if you could also share your thoughts on that and a little bit on the role that the library plays in your community in Bloomington Normal.
Sure. We have the same thing. We have people coming in to the library and using those public computers, and we try to work with them and really meeting people where they're at. We've grown in our outreach too. I think that's something that a lot of libraries, and I know Chicago's doing too. I've heard they've doing story times at laundromats, and so we're trying to do some of those same things here, where we're reaching out and really meeting people where they're at in their lives and their physical locations, and trying to. Even if the brick and mortar is a little bit intimidating for people, then maybe we can meet them in the community, and then they'll have a friendly face that they'll see when they actually come to the physical location.
Hmm. And Jeannie, as we've been talking about changes to the ways that libraries are dealing with late fee policies, I imagine there's somewhat of a balance that needs to be achieved between libraries trying to do right by their patrons, but also making sure they're getting what they need to be able to take care of the needs of their communities, I guess, financially. So there are alternatives to having fines or not having fines. I understand the Champaign Public Library has automatic renewals. Can you tell us more about some of these other alternatives that are out there as well as we consider making these kinds of changes?
Sure. We actually worked with Champaign and Decatur to do a presentation at the Illinois Library Association Conference last October, and it was called Removing Barriers, and we presented three different options that each of us have done. So we presented about our Fresh Start program, where we waived everything at a single point in time, and then Decatur is fine-free as well, and so they've presented on that, and then Champaign talked about the auto-renewal program. So that was just a way to show that there are different options and thinking outside the box. We certainly saw our Fresh Start program as a way to test the waters or take a small step. And then recently at our October board meeting, our library board did approve doing automatic renewals, which prevents those late fees from just forgetting to renew the item, or maybe with the digital divide, so someone who doesn't have access to internet at home, it might be harder for them to renew those items. So hopefully that will remove that barrier that exists as well. So we're going to implement that in April of next year.
Oh, really neat. And we just have about a minute left. But Andrea, I mean, we mentioned the size of the Chicago Public Library System. It's one of the largest in the nation. You all also have a budget of about $130 million. What would you say to some of the smaller library systems that might face certain challenges in making some of these changes about the feasibility of doing it?
Well, I mean, I think that, you certainly have to look. I mean, the funding structure for libraries in different cities is different in every city or in many cities. But I think it's really important to look at the whole picture and understand about, to look at really, is revenue coming from overdue materials a true revenue stream, or is it an anticipated stream? What we found is that while we did collect a small amount of revenue, about less than 1% of our full budget, the amount of revenue or the amount of fines that were just sitting in patrons' accounts was much, much higher than what we were actually collecting. And then also, it's the value of the books that are not being returned to the library. So I think it's really important to look at the whole picture. We looked at the fact that there was about $3.9 million worth of materials that were sitting overdue in patrons' accounts, and we would rather get those materials back in order to get them in the hands of other patrons. Mm-hmm. So we really looked at the big picture.
That was Chicago Library Commissioner Andrea Telly speaking with Christine Herman. We also heard from Jeannie Hamilton. She's the library director for the Bloomington Public Library. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Reginald Hardwick. There is a growing body of research that suggests dance and the arts can be beneficial for both the mental and physical health of people living with Parkinson's. That's a disease that affects the central nervous system, which can make certain movements difficult. Over the past decade, a national nonprofit called Dance for People with Parkinson's Disease has been working to support people with Parkinson's and their loved ones through dance, music, and artistic expression. There are classes in more than 200 communities around the globe, including in Champaign-Urbana. This past winter, 21st show producer Anna Casey attended a class at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts and brought us back this audio postcard. She started by asking Steve Douglas what brought him to the class.
My sense that I'm losing my sense of balance and otherwise just not very fit, and I've learned a lot about I've learned to appreciate professional dancers and dancing because they make it look so easy. I'm told that people gain some capabilities that they might have lost. Walking through a doorway becomes doable if you've been dancing.
Thanks to producer Anna Casey for that audio postcard from the Krannert Center's Dance for People with Parkinson's Disease program. Back in December, Christine Herman sat down with dance instructor Kate Insulia and class coordinator Whitney Hayweiss to find out more about how the program got started. Christine started by asking Kate to describe what the class is like.
The Dance for People with Parkinson's class originated. Mark Morris Dance Troupe in New York City started this program, and he created a syllabus for how the classes would go. And there are exercises that are set up to particularly help people who have Parkinson's disease. You know, we begin with a warm-up. There's two separate warm-ups, and they work with different parts of the body. The beginning of the warm-up is very general, just working very big and right and left. And then the second part of the warm-up, you cross the body a lot more and you use the upper body and the lower body together and just keeps progressing. You learn choreography. You do footwork. You do, we call it a brain teaser, so movement that will progressively challenge your brain to work more complexly with your body.
Yeah.
Probably 60 or 70% of the class is done in a chair.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really lovely class. What I like about it is we have a lot of fun and people get to laugh a lot together and get to be with other people who are also struggling with the disease, living with the disease. And it's a lot of fun. It's a community. Yeah. It's a really community experience.
And for people with Parkinson's who may have trouble with movement just because of the nature of the disorder and the way it affects the central nervous system, does it make it challenging for them to participate? And do you sense from people maybe a hesitation at the beginning to participate and do the types of things that you're doing in the class?
Yeah, sure. There's a lot of, will I be able to do it? But everyone, people really do dive into it and give it a shot. And yeah, there are complications, right? People start shaking or your arm goes right instead of left. The reason that it's a dance class. So what's different than like going to like an exercise class or just doing physical therapy is that you're moving with music. And we have a live pianist in the class, Beverly Hilmer. What starts happening is your body feels that rhythm in the music and your brain hears that, and it distracts you in a way from just thinking so directly about, I'm going to move my hand. The music helps your body not have to think so hard and just kind of go with it.
Yeah, because there have been a lot of studies done that show that, you know, even when the brain can no longer recognize or do the things that it used to, music will still connect the brain to sort of its, you know, cognitive functions. So that's one of the reasons why they use music so much in the Dance for People with Parkinson's class and other similar programs.
That's interesting to think about the differences between a dance class for someone with Parkinson's versus like physical therapy, because that's one of the questions I had, like, you know, how is this different? But that makes a lot of sense. Dance for People with Parkinson's Disease is actually a national organization. It's a nonprofit collaboration between the Mark Morris Dance Group in New York, as you mentioned, Kate, and the Brooklyn Parkinson Group. The group also helps train teachers and operates, I learned, in 25 countries and in about 250 communities, including here in Champaign-Urbana, for the past 10 years. So can you talk a little bit about the origins of the program that we have here in East Central Illinois, how it came about, maybe how it's changed since then?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Mark Morris Dance Group has had a longstanding relationship with Krannert Center. They come every year and do performances, and they also do a week-long residency. So as part of their residency every year, they would do their Dance for Parkinson's class, and it became so popular that we thought, why don't we develop this into our own program? And they were kind of just getting started with spreading the class and the program around the country. So we actually sent two instructors out to California to train with the Mark Morris Dance Group, and then they brought that training back here, and we started our own monthly class.
And the training, Kate, you were describing it a little bit. Actually, one of our producers for the 21st show went to the class on Friday, and she was describing it a little bit for me, that there's a lot of helpful movements that you guide people through. And so a lot of the training, I'm guessing, does it involve kind of just learning about how to teach dance specifically to someone who is living with Parkinson's disease and how you need to, like, make adjustments for that?
Yeah. Laura Caramonte, she's not with us today, but I co-teach with her. So she trained me. And, yeah, so Laura talked to me about that it's really important when I'm teaching any of the movements to have visuals that they can think about, like you're a butterfly and you're moving through the air, and something to connect them other than just saying move your hands like this, but to give a visual, something that your body will just automatically hook into.
Yeah, and I think the class has changed a lot over the years, too, to kind of take into account what the current mobility is of our regular participants, and that group of regular participants has had some turnover over the years, and so I think that Kate and Laura do a really great job kind of taking into account their comfort level, their mobility, and kind of molding the class a little bit to what they feel comfortable doing.
I'm speaking with Whitney Hayweiss. She's class coordinator for Krannert Center's Dance for People with Parkinson's program. I'm also joined by Kate Insolia. She's an instructor for Dance for People with Parkinson's and also the owner and artistic director of Urbana Dance Company. What's interesting, I learned that there are numerous peer-reviewed research studies on the impact of dance on people with Parkinson's. And in fact, recently, the World Health Organization Regional Office for Europe concluded in a report that engaging with the arts can be beneficial for both mental and physical health. I'm just curious to hear, does any of this surprise you at all, being people who work in this space, bridging the arts with, as a way of helping people with Parkinson's? Kate, can we start with you?
Yeah, no, that doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, I'm a dancer. So I've devoted my life to doing this art form. And I mean, that's what happens in the class. It's a place where you have to set aside kind of your thinking and your worries and your thoughts and come together and just move together and just emotionally. It's very emotional. You get to express. We do games where it's like, now we're going to pretend that we haven't so much done like sad or happy, but we'll do small movement or big gestures or wave across the room to someone. Or
so there's like components of theater too.
There's components of theater. Well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whitney, what about, have you heard from participants or their loved ones, caregivers and others? Like, what do you hear from them about why they like to participate?
I've heard, you know, such positive feedback from our participants and also from their loved ones and their caregivers that this class kind of gives everyone a sense of community and family and also fun. And it also, I think, gives them a little bit of a respite to kind of just give themselves a break from, you know, sort of living with their symptoms. And they get to, you know, listen to this wonderful music and just kind of let their movements and the emotions that they feel in that music kind of out in the open through their movements. And, you know, that music connecting to their brain, connecting to their bodies and how it all moves together, I think just really creates this joyous atmosphere.
And Kate, I mean, I imagine some of the people taking the class, maybe they've taken dance before, but maybe others, this is the first dance class they're taking. Is it really a mix?
It really is. I'm surprised sometimes people that are in the class, they're like, you know, my whole life when I was younger, I did the Lindy Hop or I used to take ballet classes. And then they bring their spouse who never did any of that, but they're coming to support their partner. And you know, it's funny because a lot of times they'll get nervous. I can't do this. Oh my gosh, I'm terrible at it. Or have this, think that. And it's just not true. They just do these beautiful dances and this beautiful job at moving. It's just, I'm always taken away. Every time I'm like, and now we're going to go do a performance because they look so beautiful every time they move. And to me, dance is art making. And art making to me is about deeply connecting to yourself and connecting to others as you're moving and creating beauty together. And so that happens at every class. Every class, I think people are surprised to see that they just moved in this very lovely, unpredictable way that they would not have done if they had not been in the class. So Laura and I are really into, for the choreography piece, taking a piece of poetry. And we will read the poetry and create movement to the poetry. And Beverly will have music. She will improvisation music to it. And it always just creates the most lovely dances. And we pick poems that are about hope and inspiration and life. And we've been doing a lot of ones that are about nature. And these lovely dance art pieces are created.
And so I'm hearing you guys talk about it's not just about the physical movement. It's the art, and it's also the community.
Mm-hmm.
How important is that aspect? You're bringing people together. You're teaching this dance class. But it's also a place where they're finding support and understanding from people who are going through similar things, I imagine.
Yeah, we always have, in the beginning of class, we have some time. People get to connect and talk. People come every time, and if someone doesn't come, we miss them. Everyone will be like, wait, where is she? She didn't come back. Or, you know, we really expect to see each other every month, and we laugh with each other, and we also get to see each other. Sometimes people's symptoms get worse, and we're together. We notice that together. Yeah. And
kind of go experience, you know, those kinds of hills and valleys together. The group has really become like a family. And every few years, like Kate said, as people's symptoms, you know, maybe get worse and they can't come as regularly anymore. But, you know, we have one participant who has been there since the very first class. And he's still coming regularly. And, you know, we have lost some members over the years. We lost one of our original instructors, Kate, also named Kate. Cooper. And so, you know, we've kind of experienced all of those things that a family,
unit kind of can experience together. And I think that's another thing that makes the class so special, is that it's not just about, you know, hey, let's meet and, you know, listen to some music and do some movement every month. It just really is this, you know, just this unit of comfort and acceptance and support. And a lot of our participants also know each other through other Parkinson's organizations in the community, different support groups. And so they kind of all go to these things together, and they just have a really strong, you know, kind of connection with each other.
I'd like to thank Whitney Hayvice. She's the class coordinator for Cranite Center's Dance for People with Parkinson's program. I'd also like to thank Kate Insolia. She's instructor for Dance with People with Parkinson's Disease and the owner and artistic director of Urbana Dance Company. Both of you, thanks so much for being with me. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Christine Herman speaking with dance instructor Kate Insolia and class coordinator Whitney Havis back in December. That's it for today. I'm Reginald Hardwick. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thank you for listening.